listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Paul Tough's first book, Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem in America, which was published in 2008 to great acclaim, was called the most cogent, provocative, and original thinking on urban poverty to come along in many, many years. His new book is How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. The book illuminates the extremes of American childhood for rich kids, a safety net drawn so tight it's a harness, for poor kids, almost nothing to break their fall. Though the title, How Children Succeed, makes the book sound like an instruction manual for parents, it's really a guide, as Annie Murphy Paul wrote in the New York Times, to the ironies and perversities of income inequality in America. And as the daughter of a dedicated Head Start teacher, I applaud Paul Tough's focus on how to help children thrive and his research into the innovations that have transformed schools and teaching in our country. Paul has written extensively about education, child development, poverty, and politics, including cover stories in the New York Times Magazine on character education, the achievement gap, and the Obama administration's poverty policies. His writing has appeared in many other publications, including The New Yorker and Esquire, and on the op-ed page of the New York Times. His reporting for his new book, How Children Succeed, took him all over the country, from a pediatric clinic in a low-income San Francisco neighborhood to a chess tournament in Central Ohio to a wealthy private school in New York City. And he takes the reader through experiments that studied childhood nurture or attachment theory to report cards that featured character strength assessments. There's so many pressing issues in our education system today, and we're going to make sure there's plenty of time for you to ask Paul Tough your questions. So please do be thinking of them, and we will circulate microphones for you, and please wait until they come to you as we record for podcast. And in conversation tonight with Paul Tough is LA's favorite commentator and radio host, author of a best-selling book, public television host, blogger, and columnist. She's covered everything from national political campaigns to the Super Bowl, from riots and earthquakes to the fall of the Berlin Wall. Pat Morrison, it was founding host and commentator for Life and Times on KCET, where she won 6 Emmys and 6 Golden Mike Awards. We're proud to say she is a loyal friend to Aloud and the Los Angeles Public Library. Please join me in welcoming Pat Morrison and Paul Tough tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone. It's a school night, so we'll start. Paul Tough is here to tell you that your grandmother was right, that all those words like gumption and stick-to-itiveness that made you roll your eyes when she talked about it, about finishing your homework at night, or your father saying you've got to get up early in the morning and have a breakfast and make sure that you get all your chores done, that all of that ends up mattering. All of those character issues that we tended to sideline, that you remember Doonesbury made fun of the self-esteem movement in California in the 1970s, all of these things end up mattering and are predictors in so many ways of how kids perform in schools and how they become adults. It isn't so much test scores as it is this character that helps to shape those performances. On top of which, he talks about, as you heard Louise saying, some kids who didn't have grandparents telling them this lesson at all, who don't have parents telling them this lesson at all. And the losses aren't just in the people who seem to be struggling the most with single parents or with poverty or the 47%. They're with the 1% too. And some of these kids are so privileged and live lives so distant from their parents that they have been deprived of some of these same aspects of character by the very privileges of their upbringing. So as of course you heard from Louise, we're going to have lots of time to talk about this with you, but also with Paul Tough about his book, subtitled Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. So I'm glad you're here.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Didn't you feel a little bit like a 19th century manifest destiny kind of writer, like the American character and bringing the American spirit to this. This is an old concept that you're taking another look at beyond the scores and the numbers and the No Child Left Behind concepts.
Yes. Well, yes and no. I mean, I do think that in lots of ways, when you look back at the history of American education and American child development, there's a real pendulum swing. So William James, the philosopher and thinker, said that education is character, that that's really what we're doing, is we're building the habits that look like character. But then at other times in American history, I think character has really been absent. So I think what I'm trying to do in this book is two things. One is to try to push the pendulum back a little bit, because I think especially in the last couple of decades, it has swung about as far as possible toward an idea where we just think that cognitive skills and IQ are what matter, where we think that what can be measured on standardized tests is the only thing that matters in the success of a child. But I also think that the character strengths that I'm talking about and that the educators and scientists who I'm writing about are talking about are a little bit different than what our grandparents were talking about, that their vision of character is a little bit different. And I think the way that vision is different is that they're talking about a character strengths that are malleable, that in some ways are more about skills than about innate qualities.
And so there are two points that come through. One is that there are early determinants for these things, that the children, and you, I think you've all, you go to the grocery store, to the park, and you kind of see it, and you may wince. You see the parents who are maybe whacking their kids and saying, sit down, shut up, don't go running over there. All these negative reinforcements versus the positive ideas of what your character should be. And you just cringe because you're imagining that child 20 years from now and thinking, what sort of life will that child have? So let's talk first about some of the early determinants of character and the points at which parents or anybody else can enter into a child's life to make those differences, and how small, at least at the moment, those differences, those actions seem to be with such big outcomes years down the road.
I agree. So there are two main things, I think, that happen in a child's life, especially children growing up in adversity, that can negatively impact their character early on. One is just being in an environment that's full of stress, trauma, noise, violence. We now know from the science of stress that that takes an enormous toll on the development of the stress response system. And that the stress response system, which for a long time we thought was just another sort of interesting system in our body that developed like everything else, the stress response system turns out to be really predictive of all kinds of outcomes, health outcomes, psychological outcomes, and cognitive outcomes, specifically these skills called executive functions that matter a whole lot on the first day of school. And then the other important predictor early on is your relationship with your parents. So that if a child has a close, what's called an attachment relationship with their parent, which is just sort of a close, nurturing, attuned relationship, especially in the first year or two of life, that is entirely positive. That is a very strong predictor for all kinds of good outcomes. And especially for kids who are growing up around a lot of that sort of adversity, around trauma and stress, the amazing thing about a close relationship with an adult is that it insulates that child from a lot of those problems. So if there are kids who grow up in great adversity, have that strong relationship with a parent, and don't suffer the same effects of all of that adversity.
For purposes of this book, how did you define character?
It's not easy. The skills that I'm talking about include things like grit and curiosity, optimism, perseverance, persistence, conscientiousness, and what's...
I have all those merit badges.
You do? You've got every one of them? I've got... Yeah, I'm like 2 for 6, I think. But what's complicated about studying these, or writing about them, is that, you know, so these are skills that economists are talking about, neuroscientists are talking about, psychologists are talking about, educators are talking about, but they're all talking about it with different language. So economists call these non-cognitive skills, not a very evocative phrase. Psychologists call them personality traits.
Non-cognitive meaning it's hard to measure them on standardized tests?
There's a lot of problems with the phrase non-cognitive skills, including the fact that many of the skills are cognitive. one of the main characters in the book is this economist, James Heckman, and he's in many ways was my guide through a lot of this research. He's trying to piece together a lot of the research from different fields. And it was he was a big part of calling them non-cognitive skills. And it's sort of like an economist's view of the world. In the past, they thought that this sort of narrow range of cognitive skills were what mattered. He found that there was something else that was making a big difference in terms of children's success, and he couldn't think of what to call it, and so he called it non-cognitive skills. But as he started talking to psychologists, which is something that economists don't often do, he discovered that actually there was a whole lot of cognition involved in a lot of these.
How much is, and maybe nobody has been able to measure this either, how much is nature and how much is nurture?
In my opinion, it is much more nurture than I think we think. I think we tend to believe that many of these traits are things that are set in us from birth. And certainly genes matter. There's an estimate that I hear a lot that, you know, most predictors are sort of 50-50, that your genes and your environment are about 50-50. There's some pretty convincing evidence that for kids who are growing up in adversity, the environment matters more, that their genes don't get the opportunity to fully flourish because their environments are so difficult. But it remains a big debate. But what I'm trying to focus on in this book is how important the environment is, and I think it's absolutely important for everybody.
And what can be done to influence that environment? Because as I was reading this, it seemed like there were two points. There's so many things that we talk about at the school level, K-12, but so much of what you talk about here are elements that are formed in the very earliest years or even months of a child's life, when that life is sort of hidden from the public life in
right.
the sense that you take your baby home and you bring up your baby in your apartment or your house, and that's beyond the scrutiny, beyond the reach of people who would say, this is an important part. It's important for me to get to you as a parent
right.
to reach this child early on. That seems to be as much of a conundrum as the second part, which is what should or does happen or does not happen in schools.
It is, I think, a real challenge to our sense of what the public's role is in the family. And I think, you know, the idea of not having the government invade people's families is a very American one, and I think there's lots of good reasons for it. But at the same time, you know, what we're learning about child development tells us how important that family environment is, how much of this is shaped by before the first day of kindergarten, and especially, you know, with kids growing up in adversity, how important those early years are. And so if we want to do what I think we all want to do, which is increase opportunity for kids growing up in adversity, have at least more equality of opportunity, even if we don't necessarily have equality of outcomes, we've got to figure out what are the obstacles to that opportunity. And so many of those obstacles are taking place in families. So I actually think that there is a solution to this. I think that there's a way to, you know, we support families and intrude on families in all sorts of ways already, but we don't do it in a really organized and mostly supportive way. And when interventions do go into families, families of especially poor families, they can have really remarkable results in how kids' lives turn out. And so I think there's a way to do it that doesn't feel invasive or intrusive or aggressive, but that feels supportive.
And yet, if that woman in the grocery store, if I were to go up to her and say, will you please stop hitting your kid, she might turn around and hit me.
And so I would say that's not the right time to do it. You know, but
until I've checked out and make a dash for the parking lot.
But actually, I mean, in a way, like, that actually is when we intervene, you know, and it's sort of, you know, I mean, that's Child Protective Services, right? That is the one place where we intervene in the lives of troubled families, is like we wait until the kid's been actually hit and we can prove it, and then we intervene in that family. And that system, you know, it's good that we have those laws. It's good that we're doing that. That is not the most efficient way to help those kids. And so, you know, I believe every parent wants to have a good relationship with their children. That mother could have used lots of help before she got to that parking
right.
lot. And if we found a way to do that, she wouldn't be in that situation.
We've got to get to the poor little rich kids in a minute. But I was reading this, I was thinking, what's the reality show, Honey Bear, Boo, some? You know what I'm talking about, where the kid is having Cheetos for breakfast. And I'm thinking, why is this on television rather than in Family Protective Services? And you think, if this is public parenting in America. Does this serve your cause or does this undermine it?
Good question. I haven't sadly seen the show. So
sadly? Well,
all right.
I think we'll have plenty of comment. But the idea of this as spectacle, I think, was what really caught my attention.
And right, exactly. I mean, we do now have a way to see into these families, and it's reality TV, right? But I think it gets at something about our sort of discomfort about actually helping families and getting involved in families.
So let's talk about the rich kids whom people are inclined to think they have no problems. They certainly don't have the same kind of problems that face the poor kids that you talk about in this book, who just have multiple domino sets of problems that just collapse one after the other. These kids have no problem getting enough to eat, a place to sleep, a secure, stable environment. But there's a detached sense of parenting in some cases and a set of expectations for them that work against developing character.
I agree. So I think there are two things that
I quoted you, so I was...
Excellent. I think there are two things going on in affluent homes that are relevant here. One is, so there's a psychologist at Columbia University named Sunia Luthar who has actually studied affluence pretty carefully. She, like a lot of psychologists, started off studying kids in disadvantage, and she wanted to find out about drug use. And so she decided she needed a comparison set of kids to find out what, you know, normal kids were like. So she could compare these poor disadvantaged kids to them. And so she found this affluent private school that would let her interview the kids. She did her study and she found that the so-called control group, these affluent kids, were more depressed and used drugs more than the poor kids. And she suddenly decided she had a new focus for her research, which was kids in affluence. And she's done some really interesting research into the real psychological difficulties that kids, especially at private schools, especially at, in communities where there's a lot of pressure to succeed, the psychological toll that takes on them. And what she's identified is that it's this particular combination of high pressure to succeed in sort of measurable ways, whether it's trophies or grades or admissions to certain colleges, and low emotional connection with your parents, that creates this kind of unsolvable dilemma for kids where they just keep working and working and working to try to get the love that they want and never quite get it, and it drives them a little bit
so
crazy.
In the academic literature, it would be called the Richie Rich phenomenon.
Yes. Yes. Although Richie Rich was pretty happy.
He had
Cadbury and everyone. See, that cultural reference I did. That's my era. But the other thing that I think is going on in those affluent homes, and so I spent some time in reporting this book, reporting on these two schools in New York that together are doing a collaborative experiment on character education, trying to come up with a new way to teach character. And one school is the Kip Infinity Middle School, which is a charter school serving mostly low-income kids, and the other is the Riverdale Country School, which is one of the more exclusive private schools in New York. Tuition just topped $40,000 a year. I sort of, like Sunia Luthar, went in thinking the real actions here with the poor kids and at KIPP. But meeting the headmaster, Dominic Randolph, of Riverdale Country School, I realized he and lots of, I think, parents and teachers there felt like there was a real crisis for their kids and that their kids were too protected from adversity. And the way that Dominic put it was that character strengths, like the ones they were trying to develop in kids, like grit and self-control, come through failure. And in most high-achieving academic environments in the United States, no one really fails anything. And so these kids are deprived of this opportunity to really challenge themselves, really risk true failure, and so they don't get to develop these skills.
There's some of that in the middle class, too, in the upper middle class. The helicopter parenting, the games where everybody gets a trophy, which go back to that self-esteem parody that we saw, you know, with Doonesbury in California in the 1970s. Is that damaging in and of itself when you don't let kids test themselves because you're afraid they're going to hurt themselves, whether it's a physical hurt falling out of a tree that you've been climbing or some emotional hurt, the idea that your child cannot be allowed to fail?
Yeah, I tend to think it is. I think that there is something really valuable about letting kids fail. And I think that in some ways, self-esteem and character are somewhat opposed as ideas, that self-esteem is about sort of protecting kids, or at least the main way that we think about self-esteem is about protecting kids from negative messages. And you know, there's certainly some negative messages that it's great to protect kids from, and there are some coaches and teachers and bullies who are way too mean and can really damage kids. But at the same time, there's a certain type of instruction, whether it's from a teacher or a coach or a parent, that is really challenging to a kid. Either is sort of pulling back and letting them take responsibility for their own situation, or is pushing them, I think, to challenge themselves and go the extra mile. And I think in both cases, that is a really powerful thing. And in lots of ways, it's in tension, at least, with self-esteem.
Can you think of examples in your own life where you had that kind of adversity and it served you well?
Well, there's the dropping out of college part.
Yes. I was hoping you'd get to that. He did have an upward trajectory, rather like Bill Gates afterwards, with maybe a few zeros lopped off.
Many, many, many zeros, yeah. So I feel like I was actually in a situation like a lot of these kids. And it wasn't until I did this reporting that I really had this new way of looking at what happened to me in my late teens. So I went to a very competitive, high-achieving high school in Toronto and did well and went to Columbia University. And when I got there, I think that what I felt was that even though there was lots of the same sort of stress and pressure that I'd been under in high school, there wasn't really a lot of challenge. That for me at least, I wasn't able to find something that felt like there was a real risk of failure. So I dropped out, and I did the strange thing, which is that I bought a bicycle and a tent, and I bicycled and camped from Atlanta to Halifax. So at the time, I just thought this was sort of a fun trip, and it seemed to make sense. It didn't make sense, but it seemed to make sense. But looking back at that through the lens that Dominic Randolph has, I think what I was trying to do was give myself some challenge. And it was very challenging. I had never done a trip like this. I was on my own. It was, there was lots of failure. I failed all the time, took lots of wrong turns, lots of flat tires. And I made it to Halifax. And I think that experience of living through that kind of adversity really helped me. I think that in the end it made me a lot stronger, more confident, and gave me some character that helped me the rest of my life.
How have we arrived at this risk aversion model for kids?
Well, if my son ever tells me that he's going to take a bicycle trip when he's 18, he's grounded for life. It's a good question. I think it's a really big cultural shift, and like all cultural shifts, it's hard to pin it on any one thing. I think we've become much more anxious about our kids. I think the idea of like an 18-year-old bicycling alone and camping alone in the woods of North Carolina now seems like a little crazy. There's lots of reasons why in American history it makes lots of sense. 18-year-olds have done much more dangerous things than that. I think that there's also been this real focus on cognitive skills that as I talk in the book about this one study that came out in the 1990s from the Carnegie Corporation about the importance of the early years of life in terms of cognitive ability. And in lots of ways, I think that it was this report that started what a couple of economists call the rug rat race, this kind of insane anxiety about how quickly we can get cognitive skills into our kids. So it was what started Baby Einstein and Mozart CDs in the womb and flashcards and this and Junior Kumon and all this sort of worry that like the first few years of life were a race to get cognitive skills as quickly as possible. And I think that mindset is something that a lot of parents share now. It's a real anxiety. And I think when you feel like life is a race or childhood is a race to get the right kind of credentials and the right kind of skills, then it's really difficult to allow in risk because risk can get you off track. It certainly got me off track. So I think that has something to do with it.
There's also the question of sort of free range, giving children some free range and the questions of focus. And my column in Tomorrow's Times is with E.O. Wilson, the biologist, the naturalist. And I asked him, at one point, I said, why don't kids like just lie down in the grass and look at ants or collect snakes anymore? And he says, there's just too much else going on inside with too much technology to distract them. And one of the things that seems to challenge character is that idea of focus. You cite a couple of studies, the famous marshmallow study, mm-hmm. a New Zealand study, that if kids can't delay gratification, if they can't focus, then they lose at a very early age some of these skills that become determinants of character. So there are many things that are militating against it, including that focus. I mean, Abe Lincoln could not put down the charcoal he was writing on the slate and turn on the television.
Right. So
can you talk about that, those questions of focus, and how people are disinclined to give children not just the questions of roaming around in North Carolina at 18, but giving them the run of you know, their friends' backyards when they're 6 years old?
So in lots of ways, I think this connects with the character strength of curiosity. And curiosity is a really difficult thing to teach because I tend to think that the less you do as a parent or a teacher, the more curious kids get. That, you know, so my son is 3, and he, I feel like, is at maximum curiosity right now. He does want to, like, sit in the backyard and play with ants and snakes and things like that. And so my worry is that what I do and what schools do to him is going to be just to diminish that curiosity. In terms of I mean, to me, like the marshmallow study and the New Zealand study are partly about that focus, but I think they're also about this idea of conscientiousness, which, I don't know, should we talk about conscientiousness, or do you want to stay on
curiosity? Let's define what the two studies are first.
Okay.
So. I wish I'd brought marshmallows because we could, like, do the marshmallow study here, and then we could see how many of you.
We have chocolate-covered pretzels.
Okay, all right.
So the marshmallow study is one. It's one of the more famous social science studies, just because it's so much fun. So many of you may have heard about this study. This was done by a professor at Stanford named Walter Mischel back in the...
also known as Stay Puffed.
He did more to promote marshmallow sales than any other social scientist. So what he did, he wanted to test how kids resisted temptation. So he came up with this pretty ingenious experiment where he took a bunch of 4-year-olds and he would bring them into a room, put down a marshmallow or another treat in front of them. There would be a bell on the table as well. And then he would say, here's the deal. I'm going to leave the room. If you want to eat the marshmallow, you just ring the bell, and I'll come back and give it to you. But if you wait until I get back, you can have 2 marshmallows. So it was a test of delay of gratification. And he actually intended it as a way to find out what sorts of skills kids used to resist temptation. He had thought, and as many people did at the time, that the best way to get kids to focus on 2 marshmallows was to get them to stare at that 1 marshmallow, that the more it was at the center of your attention, the more you would be motivated to go for those double marshmallows. But in
fact, I hear a lot of parents chuckling out there.
But in fact, the opposite was true, and that the kids who were able to resist the longest were the ones who were able to pretend the marshmallow wasn't there. Some of them, like, would get underneath the table so they didn't have to look at it. My favorite kid actually took a nap. He just lay down and went to sleep. He should have got like 50 marshmallows that kid. But what the study turned out to be was a test of what delay of gratification skills predict later on. Because Walter Mischel, he was doing the experiment on the classmates of his kids in a Stanford preschool. And so his kids continued to go to school with these kids, and as they grew up and got into high school, he would sort of hear reports, as one does, about one's kids' friends, about who was doing well. And he started to get curious about how their marshmallow test results correlated with how they were doing in life. And so he pulled out his tests and gave these kids some new studies to find out what they were up to, and has continued to study them and found really strong correlations between the number of minutes that they waited for the marshmallow and how well they did on all sorts of predictors, from SAT scores to college graduation rates.
Police records.
Exactly. And so the marshmallow study is not the most scientifically pure study out there. It is a great study, and it's certainly suggestive of a lot of interesting correlations. But there is another study that, Pat, you said you wrote about, that was done in New Zealand or over the course of many years, that was much more carefully done in terms of how delay of gratification and conscientiousness and self-control in childhood correlate with positive outcomes. And the positive outcomes are really strong. When kids have these scores early on, they do better. They stay married more. They get arrested less. They take drugs less frequently. They live longer. Their health is better. All sorts of positive outcomes.
And that may not be about IQ or some of these measurable standards that you say have been
right.
So important to us.
I think it's not at all about IQ. I mean, self-control skills some other non-cognitive skills are basically not correlated with IQ at all. And so to me, what that New Zealand study shows is that there are certain skills, and in this case it's conscientiousness, that are very predictive of outcomes. But we don't spend a lot of time in schools trying to teach them.
How do you in schools teach those character skills when kids have already been with their families for 5 years? They may have inculcated already in them habits that are hard to break. How do you... you don't want to unbuild, but maybe to redirect a little. How do you do something like that? You talk about the KIPP academies, a small school, private school like Riverdale, but how do you do it in a place like the LA Unified School District?
Well, that's the trick. I don't think we know yet. And I think we're at the stage right now, and certainly this experiment that KIPP and Riverdale are doing, I'm writing about not because I think it's the answer, but because I think it's interesting that they've got these seven character strengths and they're trying to figure out how to teach them. And I think they're having some success, but I don't think we know yet. The one thing that I think we're closest to knowing is that I think there are two times in a child's life that are particularly good for trying to improve their non-cognitive skills. One is early childhood, those first couple of years of life when kids are particularly malleable and particularly susceptible to the environment. And the other is adolescence. And in adolescence, kids become what this one psychologist I write about calls metacognitive, that they're suddenly able to reflect on themselves in a way that younger children are not. And as you know, if you hang out with teenagers, they actually like reflecting on themselves a whole lot. They spend a lot of time doing it. And so that is actually something that you can take advantage of. And so I had expected when I started writing about this stuff that I would be spending a lot of time in early childhood interventions. But really, I spent most of my time in middle school and high school, because that's a time where you can talk to kids and you can say, let's look at these patterns that you have in your life. Let's look at these skills you have, these strengths you have, and let's try to change them. And when kids hear that message and have the right kind of motivation to change them, they can make really remarkable transformations.
How do you put that into a curriculum without it being politicized or conflated with, let's have lessons in patriotism or, you know, some other iteration of what the idea of character is?
I'd say we don't know yet. I'd say the closest thing is this one, the closest thing to a curriculum that I think will work is this one program that I write about in Chicago called One Goal. Let me just say about patriotism first. So there is this distinction that I talk about in the book that people who study character education write about, that there are these two different kinds of character strengths, one set called moral character and one set called performance character. And in the past, there was this previous flurry of character education in the 1990s when President Clinton and Hillary Clinton both talked about character education. President Clinton mentioned it in a State of the Union address, and there were all these character education programs that popped up in schools. And they kind of fell apart, and they fell apart because it became this political debate broke out where people on the right thought that character education was being used to promote, you know, diversity and multiculturalism and terrible things like that, and people on the left thought that character education was being used to promote patriotism and
conformity.
Cleanliness and terrible things like that. And so
and we know where cleanliness is.
So what ended up happening is some of these character education programs died, and others, I think, just became sort of watered down. And so what this new generation of character educators that I read about is trying to do is focus on these performance character strengths, which are things like organizational skills, social intelligence, perseverance, grit, And in lots of ways, they do make more sense for a school to try to teach because they are skills that don't necessarily make you a good moral person, but they make you a more effective person. And that's kind of what school is for, to help you succeed. So I was answering all that to say how you teach these things. So on to one goal. So one goal is this program that I want to talk about for just a second, that is a three-year program in the Chicago public schools in some really very low-performing schools with kids who are the first person in their family to go to college, aren't specially selected. It's a three-year program in junior and senior year of high school and freshman year of college. And it's a full-time class. So these kids are in class with this teacher one session a day, all through their junior and senior years. And it's designed to increase not just college access for these low-income kids, but college persistence. And in the Chicago public schools, especially for African-American students, college persistence is really terrible. I think 8% of all Chicago public school freshmen go on to graduate from a four-year college. And for African-American males, I think it is 3%, mm-hmm. Which is really bad. And so they're trying to increase this. And the way they're doing it is through what I think to be character education, even though they don't use the term character. They're trying to teach these non-cognitive skills. They call them leadership principles to kids, because there's lots of research out there that the thing that holds you back once you get to college, the reason kids drop out, like me, is that you don't have enough non-cognitive skills. That you can get through high school without a lot of grit or curiosity or self-control. If you just sort of sit in your seat and pay attention and fill out some tests, you can get through high school. But then kids go to college, and they're lacking the sort of perseverance, the ability to bounce back from disappointment, the zest to get excited about education, about new subjects, and so they drop out. And so this program is focused specifically on those skills, and it really seems to be working. The first class that I read about is just starting their sophomore year, but 85% of the kids who were selected in their sophomore year of high school are now starting their sophomore year of college. Maybe they're all going to drop out this year, but I don't think so. I think that they're going to have persistence numbers that are way, way above what most kids in Chicago public schools are achieving.
You don't just write about the broad sweep. You do have individuals in the book, and one of them is a Miss Lerma, who's a remarkable young woman who, if you could take her and make her the example for all of these classes, why don't you tell about her?
Sure. So this is Kiwana Lerma, who, when I met her, was a junior in high school at a school in the south side of Chicago, and is now, well, not to give away the end of the story, a sophomore in college. And so Kiwana had a really, really difficult life. She was poor, but she was not just poor. She had a lot of these early traumas and adversities that predict all kinds of bad outcomes. She was homeless for a while, moved around a lot, had parents who were not very focused on her. And by the time she got to sixth grade, she was an angry kid who was not able to focus. In her sixth grade year, she got sent to the principal's office 72 times. And she was put in the slow class, which they called the WINGS class, which there's some acronym for.
Yeah, but she said it was because all they did was eat chicken wings and watch movies.
Exactly. So it was supposed to be inspiring. But she just felt like completely disrespected by this class. And they didn't care, as I think happens to many kids who are like Kiwana. They didn't really care about her education. And they just, let them watch movies. And so Kiwana changed. And why Kiwana changed is, as with many people, something of a mystery. But I think that it had to do in large part with this class. But before she even got to this class, she had this one moment at the end of her freshman year of high school where she got arrested for hitting a police officer, which is really not a good idea if you're a freshman in high school. And so she was arrested in Minnesota, and when she got back to Chicago where her mom lived, her mom sat her down and said, "I don't want you to end up like me," which is, I think, an extremely difficult thing for any parent to say to her child. And they had this very intense conversation, and Kiwana started to change, and really, I think, started to change her character. She started to work harder. She started to envision a different future for herself. And then she found this class, this one goal program, and her GPA went up from like 1.8 to 4.0. She never tested well on the ACT. I think, you know, the effect of all those years of pretty lousy education, she and I think most people were not able to overcome it in terms of a test of just her cognitive skills. But she found that she was able to compensate for that with these other skills. And she has incredible character strengths. And they have pulled her not only through high school, but through her freshman year of college. So she talked to me about her strategies, her freshman year of college, many of which she learned from her teacher, but which she just took to with incredible verve. On the first day of class, she sat in the front row. She introduced herself to all her professors. She made sure she met someone in the class who she could ask for help if she couldn't reach the professor. She went to office hours every time there were any office hours. She made a note of every word that the professor used that she didn't recognize, and then went up to him after class and asked him to define all of these words. One of the leadership principles that One Goal talks about is resourcefulness, and she was incredibly skilled at figuring out all the resources she could take advantage of. And the kind of amazing thing about college is that that is enough. I mean, and that's a lot, but that you can be. So her ACT score was a. Trying to remember where she started and when she ended up. I think it was a 15 or a 16. She was at about the 20th percentile. And, you know, you're not supposed to go to college if you're at the 20th percentile. And what one of the things that I think she's demonstrated is that, A, there's a different kind of intelligence than what gets measured on those tests. And that, B, if you have all these other strengths, your ACT score, it's not that it doesn't matter, but you can absolutely compensate for it.
So we have to come up with a way to test for these other aspects of character, but she also had a vision of herself in mind. Through all of this adversity, she said, and this was so moving to me to read, she saw herself as the person walking through the lobby of a building with a briefcase in her hand and people saying, "Good morning, Miss Lerma." And she didn't know anybody in her growing up period who was that person.
Right. You know, she had this vision of herself, right, that she just invented somehow. And I think lots of kids do that, you know, envision some sort of make-believe version of themselves. But she never lost sight of it, and she actually did what very few kids do and worked backward from that and actually figured out what are all the things I'm going to need to do in order to get there. And it was a very, very long list if you're on the, you know, growing up the way she did. And with the test scores that she had and sitting in your wings class, there's a lot of things you've got to do, and she's actually doing them all.
What are the costs to society of these failures of character?
Well, so I look at these two different cohorts that I'm talking about, more affluent kids and more poor kids. And I want to be careful doing that because I do think that the ultimate sort of goals and expectations and needs of all these kids are the same. I think every kid needs the same thing, and I think every kid can succeed to really high levels. But I think that right now we have this kind of adversity gap where some kids need more protection from adversity and some kids need less protection from adversity. And so what the social cost of each of the end of that scale, I think, is different, right? So if there are lots of rich kids who aren't challenging themselves very much, not great for them and their parents, but I would argue not a huge social cost. Some people might argue there's a social cost. Maybe fewer of them will be entrepreneurs. Fewer of them will take the kind of risks that will push the country forward. But I feel like it's kind of their business. Whereas I feel like for poor kids, there is a much clearer social cost. That there's a huge cost to the fact that 3% of kids on African-American boys on the south side of, or anywhere in Chicago, going to public school, are graduating from four-year colleges. That's terrible in all sorts of ways, especially when you look at the results of One Goal and you realize that many of those kids have the potential to graduate from a four-year college. And graduating from college makes a huge difference in the lives of any individual kid, and especially if you're growing up in adversity right now, the wage gap, I think it's 80%. You make 80% more if you have a BA. And for a lot of these kids, if they don't follow that trajectory and drop out of high school or never leave the neighborhood, not only are they going to not be making a lot of money and paying taxes, but they're going to be a drain on the on public resources. So you can certainly make an economic argument for why having a better approach to education for poor kids would make a difference, but I think there's also really a moral argument that having a whole class of people, a whole neighborhood of, you know, every American city where essentially no one is succeeding in ways that we consider real success is a tragedy. It really is bad for the country in ways that are hard to measure.
But when you use the word adversity, it means very different things and compose very different things. For rich kids or kids of privilege, let me just read you this bit because it may be familiar to you. We're talking about this Riverdale school. And in a middle school, if a kid is a C student and their parents think they're all A's, we do get a lot of pushback. What are you talking about? This is a great paper. We have parents calling in and saying for their kids, can't you just give them two more days for the paper? Overindulging kids with the intention of giving them everything and being loving, but at the expense of their character, that's huge in our population. I think it's one of the biggest problems we have at Riverdale. So putting them in situations where they would deal with adversity would mean that they're not getting graded on the curve, for example.
Right.
Or they are told, look, you know, you can't use your computer. You've got to be on your own resources. Versus the adversities that are beyond the control of poor kids. They can't change their parents. They can't change the places they live. They can't get health care for themselves or even deal really with abuse. So those are two very differently weighted meanings of the word adversity.
Yes, that's true. They are, but I think they're on a continuum. I mean, I think that I feel like it's useful to think about this as a continuum of adversity. I think that if we think that, you know, the problems that poor kids face are just like a whole different category, like those kids are just a different species, there's no connection between affluent kids and poor kids, it tends to make us less empathetic, less connected, more willing to sort of write those kids off. And so, you know, absolutely, some of the, you know, the adversities that poor kids are often facing are terrible. They're terribly traumatic. But I think it's useful to know that what's going on is, you know, from the neuroscience that I write about, that actually, you know, we can actually trace the effect that these things are having. It's not some sort of magical, tragic force. It's very sad what's happening, but we can measure what it's doing. And so we can... It gives us a new way of thinking about stopping it, but it also gives us a new way of thinking about compensating for it. And I think thinking about that as a continuum where, you know, kids who are at Riverdale are not having enough adversity of any kind, I feel like that gives us a way of thinking like, really, maybe where we should all be heading is to try to equalize that adversity gap, give a little bit more adversity to some kids and a lot less adversity to others.
Before we get to questions, I wanted you to talk about how you use chess as a metaphor for some character issues in here.
So there's one chapter in the book about one chess team. I was not a chess kid growing up, but I've now spent a lot of time at some chess tournaments, and they are really extremely intense. And one of the things that you learn if you hang out at chess tournaments is that there's an achievement gap in chess just like there is in school, that most of the kids who win chess tournaments and chess trophies are rich kids or kids who go to selective schools or magnet schools. And that was true anyway until the last few years when this one school, Intermediate School 318 in Brooklyn, started winning everything. They now win every middle school tournament, and they just got on the front page of the New York Times last spring for winning the national high school tournament, which is really remarkable when you consider that none of them have ever been to high school. But they beat the best high school players in the country. And so when I was starting working on this book, they were just starting their winning streak, and I wanted to figure out what was going on. So I called up the teacher and asked if I could go visit, and I assumed there was some trick that they were somehow like selecting the best chess players from all over the city or the smartest kids, and they weren't. It's really just an average public school, and the kids who win the chess tournaments aren't the kids who score best on the standardized tests. But they have this teacher who really does a remarkable job, this woman named Elizabeth Spiegel. And talking to Dominic Randolph and others about failure and adversity actually gave me a way of thinking about what she was doing. Because I think what she was doing was giving kids a way to manage failure. And one thing I didn't know about chess is that in chess you fail all the time, that you lose about half your games no matter how good you are, and you make tons of stupid mistakes even when you do win. And when that happens to kids, they tend to have two temptations. One is to just sort of laugh it off and say, chess is a stupid game, I don't care. The other is to wallow in the shame of losing and convince themselves they're the worst player ever. And what she does is guides them between those two temptations. And the way she does it is by making them look really honestly at their mistakes. There's this ritual on the IS 318 team. After every game, you have to sit down with Ms. Spiegel and go through your whole game move by move. And I sat in on a lot of these, and they are really grueling. And they're grueling because she's kind of tough on the kids. Like, I'd expected that she would be saying, oh, well, you know, you tried your best, and at least you had fun. It's just a game. But she doesn't do any of that. She's kind of mean. She sort of picks on them. And she's like, a rook? Why would you move a rook? There's this rule of thumb in teaching that she actually told me about, that you're supposed to give 5 compliments for every 1 criticism, or the self-esteem of your students will fall below acceptable levels. And she told me about this because she was concerned. She said, you know, I think my numbers are getting a little bit low. And I was like, yeah, they're definitely getting low. For her, it was like 5 criticisms for every compliment. But the kids loved it. You know, she's not a hugger, but she had these really strong relationships with kids because she was looking honestly and clearly at what they were doing, and helping them figure out what they were doing wrong, and try different strategies. And the great thing about chess as a way to do this teaching is that you get instant feedback, right? So you do what Ms. Spiegel says the next game, and you win. So you're really motivated to keep doing what she's talking about. But I think that this strategy that she was giving them for learning how to manage your failures makes sense not just on the chessboard, but in other classes and really in life.
You talked about the big cultural shift that has gotten us here. Are we, as a country, ready to change, able, willing to change?
I think we definitely are. I mean, I definitely feel like at the not enough adversity end of the scale, I feel like what I hear from parents when I talk to parents and teachers in affluent communities and at independent schools, they're definitely eager to, I think, try something new. That I think there's a real sense that something's gone awry in our way of teaching in high achieving academic environments. In terms of the kids who need more protection from adversity, that I think is more complicated. You know, I think we have a real system in place, an education system in place that really values test scores, and that measures the success of these kids on this one narrow way. And we do not yet have a system to help kids like Kiwan Alerma turn from kids who are just going to head down a really lousy path into college graduates. And, you know, what her story and the story of lots of other kids in this book tell us is that we can do that. And so you can make lots of cases for why that's a good idea. You can make the case on economic grounds. You can make the case on moral grounds. But it really does take a national will to want to help those kids because they cannot do it themselves.
In the course of working on this book and your other book, did it change the way you deal with your own kids?
Yes, I just have 1 kid. And the timing was perhaps unfortunate for him.
You turned him loose in North Carolina with a pocket knife and some matches.
Exactly. He spends a lot of time throwing knives in the backyard. So he was born, so he's 3. So he was born just as I was starting work on this book. And so I would sit there, you know, in my room all day reading like neuroscience papers about brain development and then come out and play with them on the rug and try not to use him too much as an experimental subject. But it was sort of impossible not to. So it affected me in all kinds of ways, and I'm sure will continue to. But actually, the main way that it affected me was just to help me calm down a little bit as a parent. That I think that when he was born, I was caught up in this idea that, you know, we needed to get him the right tutor at 6 months and get the Mozart CDs going in the maternity ward. And what this research told me is that absolutely those first couple of years are very crucial, but what's crucial is not the flashcards that he sees, what's crucial is the relationship that he has with me and his mother and other people around him. That just by being attuned and connected and attached with him, we're doing more to help his character and his cognitive skills than anything else we could do.
We were joking about knives. Every kid I knew growing up had a knife. We all, you know, we whittled stuff. We made toothpicks out of logs, and that was about the extent of it. But even something like that, I trust you to know what to do with this, instead of saying, oh, don't touch that until you're 30 years old.
There are a lot of missing fingers from that generation, but...
I don't know. I can still type pretty well. But isn't that a kind of symbolic transition to
Absolutely.
What we're talking about?
Yes, I think it really is. And I think, you know, part of, I think, what is complicated about parenting, and I know I only have a three-year-old, I know many parents have figured this out before me, but, you know, the research really is very clear that in the first couple of years of life, what you need to do is to be as connected and attached as possible and to come every time they cry and to really be responsive to all of their needs. But there's also research that says that's not the right thing to do with a five-year-old or a 10-year-old or a 25-year-old who's living in your basement. That you're not actually supposed to come every time they cry, right? And so somewhere in there is a transition where you suddenly have to change your parenting. In some ways, this is obvious. Parents have been doing it forever. We know that child development is about the process of going from dependence to independence. But it's hard. It's really hard to switch gears. And for me, anyway, I think I'm more naturally attuned to the attachment, cuddling and hugging and comforting. And so now that I'm trying to, you know, stand back and let him fall and pick himself up and let him deal with his own problems, I find I really have to push myself.
So let's get some questions and we can mix it up here. We have people with microphones. If you want to raise your hand, they'll bring the microphones around to you. So let's go. We have one here first. Yes, thanks.
Hi, your talk is so interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I had a question on will and determination, and if you have any studies about that and what you can speak of in terms of a child's character and when it's developmentally appropriate to maybe support that. And again, it from my own perspective, it's about the transition you were just speaking of from an attachment parenting to moving towards an independent.
So when you say will and determination, say a little bit more about what you mean.
Well, I have a child who's not very willful and who's not particularly determined. And so, of course, my question is very selfish.
Right.
He has a very good focus. He's good on all the other areas, but he doesn't have a lot of perseverance and struggle. And so that's what I'm interested in.
So I think we don't yet know, you know, perfect rules for what makes one kid perseverant and how to develop it. My sense is that it's two things. I really do believe that that this idea of pulling back from trying to push kids and letting them figure things out for themselves, letting them fight their own battles, letting them make their own decisions about what they're interested in, tends to increase determination, that sort of experience comes through these experiences of failure that we're talking about. And I think there's a way that, you know, we want to, like, expose kids to so many different things, and we want to enroll them in so many different things and give them so many opportunities, and there are all these amazing opportunities out there. But that, you know, when I think about my own childhood, I feel like the stuff that got me excited was stuff that I found on my own. You know, that there's something about just deciding you're really into the planets or comic books or painting or poetry that is going to be exciting in a way that anything that your parents tell you about is not. And it has nothing to do with, I mean, it has something to do with the stuff itself, but it also just has to do with the excitement of discovering something and figuring out who you are. My sense is that when that happens, that kids become a lot more, you know, perseverant, that when they're doing something that's not, you know, the lesson, the violin lessons that they have to take, but it's the, like, you know, YouTube video that they want to make, suddenly they get a lot more grit and determination.
Over here.
Hey.
I have a kid who plays chess, but he also plays a lot of sports. There's one sport where if you fail 7 out of 10 times, you're a superstar. He plays a lot of baseball. So I wonder if you deal in the book at all with sports and part of that upbringing and the role of sports in education these days, which seems to be way downplayed. They barely do PE at his school. but he still plays sports 7 days a week. But still, it seems to me that's big on the character scale, too.
Okay, it's got to be. And that's a lot of what you hear from parents. I want them to play sports to build character. But if you argue with the ump every time he says your kid is out, what kind of character is that?
Right. So, yeah, I think sports is – I don't write about sports much at all in this book, but I think that absolutely they're a great way. I mean, if it's the right kind of sporting league, I think it's a great way to do it. And for me, I feel like, you know, when you think about the – when I watched Elizabeth Spiegel, this chess coach, it really struck me that, like, when people think back on teachers that have really inspired them and pushed them and made them love something, it's sometimes a math teacher, but it's more often like a chess coach or an athletic coach or a music teacher, someone who's in more of a training role than a teaching role. And there's something, and I think it's that reason. There's something about, if you're a good coach, there's something about being able to guide kids through that failure process, to let them keep trying something, keep failing, and then succeeding. That is a great character building exercise, and so that's what kids really respond to.
My question for you is more from the writer point of view. How did you take all this scientific data and human story and weave it into something that's very readable? Can you just talk a little bit about your process as a writer?
Sure. So it was agonizing. I find it very difficult. So I think I'm kind of naturally attuned to it, but I also, the writers who I like, people like Michael Pollan and lots of others, I like that way of telling stories, going back and forth between personal stories, stories of other characters, and science. You know, and I feel like, especially in terms of writing about kids in poverty, it's rare to have that combination. That I think there's one tradition of writing about kids in poverty that has some remarkable examples and some great works of nonfiction literature that's come out of it, that is really just about telling their story and not trying to reflect on it and say what might be going on here. And I felt like that was a really something that was missing and that I wanted to try to add. In terms of how to do it, I feel like it was just a lot of trial and error that I knew. I mean, I knew that there were certain.
Did it build your character?
It did. It beat it down and built it back up, like boot camp. But I felt like there were, so as I was doing my reporting, I started to feel like there were certain stories that were going to carry me through, like the chess team, like one goal, like this pediatrician in San Francisco. And each of them I felt like were interesting because they were great characters and there was something they were trying to achieve, which is always good when you're writing a story. But that also they helped me, there were questions there that I didn't know how to answer, like why was this chess coach so successful? What were they really teaching in one goal? And so it gave me an opportunity to read a lot of science at the same time.
Over here.
Hi, I'm going to try to match two questions, but if you could address what you think the role of fantasy or whimsy or compassion, grace, in development of character. And the other one is, so assuming that we get through college, what are your thoughts of the viability of liberal arts colleges and career development? I mean, a lot of these skills, of course, are moving us toward a marketable mm-hmm. job. But then for those of us who came out of liberal arts majors.
Thanks.
So the role of whimsy and creativity, right? I think it's a really key part of developing not cognitive and non-cognitive skills. So while I'm off on book tour talking about raising Ellington, my wife is at home actually raising Ellington, which is much, much harder. And it's hard right now because he has just become obsessed with make-believe, and it usually involves like these long scenarios involving puppets and trains talking to each other. And my wife texted me the other day and said, what's the minimum number of hours that I have to do make-believe? Like, when can I get off the hook?
What was your answer?
I felt like she could stop at any point, but I was impressed that she felt like she had to have a quota. And she's really, really good at it, but I, I think it's, yeah, it can get a little wearing. But so I feel like it's incredibly valuable for him. And there are actually some, there's this one curriculum called Tools of the Mind that is trying specifically to develop self-control in kids who are 4 and 5 years old. And the way that they do it mostly is through what they call mature dramatic play, which is long involved make-believe scenarios. And their theory is that that helps kids develop self-control, because when you're doing make-believe, you have to actually follow the rules of the character that you've chosen.
As far as the other, about liberal arts,
yes.
If I can extrapolate, the sense that very career-driven sort of education also creates a zero-sum world, that I win, which means you have to lose, and that all of the peripheral qualities and attributes may fall by the wayside in terms of how significant they are, which goes back to the kind of testing you were talking about. It's like a career in that testing-driven world.
I don't think I've got anything particularly helpful to say about, like, particularly, you know, choosing different majors and what pushes kids in each direction and what they get out of it. I think in both, I think there are lots of, you know, business school graduates who have gone down the path of, like, doing exactly the right thing to make a lot of money, who get out into the world and have no idea why they're there, because they've just been sort of following that treadmill through college and haven't, through academia, and haven't been pushing themselves. So, of course, they might be lost and they're making a lot of money, which is maybe better than being lost and being a, you know, English major. but I think it's also true, I think there's something parallel going on with kids who are just sort of following a dream without actually, like, developing character strengths as they do it, and so I think can go get out into the world equally lost. And so, to me, thinking about education and thinking about college, especially, as a way to sort of develop these character strengths, as instead of just a way to sort of get all the knowledge that you need in your field or profession or major, gives a more useful way to think about higher education for both the business school people and the poetry people.
Over here, please.
Yes. How much do you think that social determinants actually impact the character determinants? And if the social determinants actually have a higher impact on character determinants, then how do we as a society actually focus on that?
To say what you mean by social determinants.
So social determinants are basically what is determined based on, you know, your environment, your community, your family, all these things, zip code.
Got it. So, yeah, I think that, sure. So all of the research about, you know, trauma and adversity in early childhood and what that does to these things we end up calling character strengths, I think are really clear. When you grow up in a difficult zip code or in a social milieu that is full of chaos and violence and difficulty and stress, it's much harder to develop these skills. And in fact, I mean, one of the things, and in some ways, like, what got me into this in the first place was that, to me, it's what's appealing about this frame around poverty is that it's a different way of looking at what happens to kids who grow up in poverty. That we've always known that kids who grow up in poverty and in certain zip codes don't succeed as much as other kids. But we never really have known why, which I think has enabled us to kind of come up with our own reasons that sort of fit our worldview. And to me, thinking about it this way, looking at the science of what's actually happening if you grow up around a lot of trauma and stress, gives us a way of thinking about what's going on that is more solution-oriented. You know, this is something we can actually work on, we can actually fix.
Over here? Okay. I want to be sure to get to this man there, because he's had... There's blood draining from his hand.
I'm curious to your thoughts on the phenomenon of redshirting now, where parents are holding their children, a lot of times boys, back a year because that will benefit them immeasurably in different ways, maybe on testing and being able to sit still and focus and those sorts of things. And, you know, somebody like Malcolm Gladwell might say, you know, with his hockey analogy, that just by when you start something, that will determine whether or not you're successful. And so maybe a conscientious parent would make the choice to hold their kid back mm-hmm. or put them in at a certain time. And then what you're saying about, you know, letting your kids fail or not paving the path and that sort of thing. I'm just curious as if you have anything to say about parents who might be struggling with that sort of a decision.
And that's the sort of best intention scenario. You find other parents who will try to get their kids diagnosed as ADD so they get more time on the test, for example, when they may not be ADD at all.
Right.
So there's a whole range of this kind of thing that you were talking about.
So I know there's lots of interesting research out there about redshirting and about that sort of timing question, but I don't know enough about it to say anything useful. I guess I would tend to say the one sort of general thing I would say about all of that is that I do think that there is, you know, I think it's totally natural to want to get your kid every advantage possible in school, and so any given moment like that, I think it's understandable that you would go for that extra advantage. But I do think, in the aggregate, there's something about that kind of relationship between a parent, a child, and school that can be damaging. You know, that I think can create the sort of situation that this Columbia psychologist Sunia Luthar is talking about, where kids get the message that it is this, you know, very competitive game that they are part of, and that their worth is measured on how well they do at that game and nothing else. So I think there's something about the overall anxiety that can be negative.
Okay.
Hi. Regarding the premise that, you know, let them try and fail and eventually they'll make the right choices, I would think that that's more of a Western kind of point of view. I just recently read the book Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mom, and it seems that we're trying to get to the same place, but with a different way of approaching, where her view is, we'll help them make that decision until they internalize and they can make that decision for themselves. How do you view that? Is it a different cultural point of view, or what is it?
It's a really interesting question. So I haven't read that whole book. I just read parts of it. Yeah, I think it is. I think in lots of ways it is. I mean, I don't know if it's an Eastern versus Western cultural view, but I think it is a different cultural view, this idea that the right thing to do is to just keep pushing kids and then eventually they'll start pushing themselves. I think that that is in conflict with this idea of it's more important for kids to sort of discover their own passions, their own, you know, what gives their life meaning, whether it's, and it might not be those violin lessons. I don't think we've got definite data on what the right solution is, but I think there's certainly tension there. Yeah.
To the man who would get two marshmallows right there.
You're very kind. I had the question, on the one hand, it's so great to have whimsy and individual initiative and finding out what you're interested in, but I'm struck by the KIPP Academy and just the sheer amount of time that they put in, and it both kind of has double benefits, one being the stuff that they actually learn, because they're in there 50%, 60% more than average students, but also the character that builds, because they've got to get up early in the morning, they've got to be very disciplined, they've got so many hours at night, and when I was hearing about that, I'm like, wow, this seems, you know, very important as a society to be aiming more towards that greater amount of time, maybe not 60%, but maybe a big chunk in terms of both character and actual things that are learned. And I wanted your opinions on that.
I do think that the fact that KIPP is giving extra time is a really positive thing. That I think for, you know, mostly they're taking kids in at middle school who have mostly had not great education up till that point. And so those kids, I think, are behind in lots of ways. And so they need extra time to catch up. And I think that's really valuable. At the same time, I think there's something very positive about the way that KIPP creates a sense of group identity, which I think can be very powerful and transformative for students that are in that group. And spending a lot of the day together is an effective way to do that. One of the things that I'll just say about KIPP is that I think that this new push they're doing on character, which is still sort of taking shape. It started in New York, and now lots of other KIPP regions are starting to experiment with this character stuff. I think that it's an important new chapter for them, that in the past they have really just focused very much on kind of rigor and self-control. And I think I write about David Levin and his first class in the Kipp Academy, and they did great on test scores, but they didn't do great on college persistence. And in some ways, that's what pushed him to do all this new thinking about character. And I think it's because the old Kipp vision of character was just about self-control. And self-control and conscientiousness are really important. They're really great predictors, but they're not enough because they're just about, you know, sort of following rules and controlling your impulses. And when you get to college, you know, you got to do something more than just follow the rules and control your impulses. So for instance, you know, some of the character strengths that they now have at Kipp include things like zest and curiosity, which are very different than self-control and arguably like in opposition to self-control. If you're a middle school teacher, like having a class full of zesty kids is kind of rough. But one of the reasons I really admire what they're doing is that they are, I think, challenging this kind of their own vision of Kipp, and I think other people's caricature of Kipp as being like very, you know, rigorous and controlled. And they're saying these kids need a broader definition of character if they're going to make it through college.
Last question here.
This is great. I'm really glad you asked that, because what I wanted to find out, there's a big national debate with teachers and this whole concept of teacher evaluation having being impacted by student performance. And the debate is, we don't want that, the teachers and parents and students saying we think that that should be a key component, if not the major component, to teacher evaluation. With this characterization or non-cognitive type of skills, can you kind of elaborate on what you think about how that could help this debate or some of the laws that are getting ready to be enacted?
It is a very frustrating and messy debate. I've been writing about education reform now for like 6 years, and I've almost given up writing about it because I feel like the debate is just getting very calcified into these two sides. So what I tend to feel about teacher evaluations is that, you know, absolutely, I think we all share the goal that we have better teachers and maybe that we get rid of some bad teachers, and certainly that we better train the teachers that we've got and recruit better teachers. I'm not convinced that including standardized test score data in evaluations is the best way to do that. And my worry about the debate is that that is where all of the focus has gone. And to me, it's just a tiny, tiny little question, like how much of that teacher evaluation. And in some ways, like all of our discussion about what to do for kids in poverty has gotten boiled down to this one very picayune point. But I would say, you know, one of the reasons I'm skeptical about it is that I think that, you know, we know that what helps a kid succeed is lots of things that can't be measured on those standardized tests. And, you know, I want teachers who can teach kids and get them BAs, whether they're kindergarten teachers or second grade teachers or high school teachers. What I really want is more BAs for kids, especially who are growing up in poverty. And so we don't have a way of measuring that now. And I worry that, you know, the more that we incentivize teachers to focus on narrow results that don't necessarily predict college persistence, the less time they're going to have to work on other things that might help more with college persistence.
So Paul Tough is going to be signing his book. Will you thank him and love your library?
Thank you, Pat.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.